Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dadgum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dadgum, dadgum, dadgum government. Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love them sometimes? Uh-huh. Well, your dadgum government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get down, get down, get down, government? Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometimes? Uh-huh.
Well, welcome to Handling the Truth. This is Tenacity, Terry Dodd. Here with the Rebel Madman, Mike Getty, and tonight we also have joining us for this panel discussion, Daryl Wayne. Mike, you want to introduce Daryl?
Well, Daryl is a gentleman I met on the crazy recesses of the internet, as he put it before. Met him several years back, and we talked quite frequently, and then along comes 2017, and Daryl invites me to Alabama to come and speak there, which I did. And Daryl and I talked at length then. It's always better when you can talk face-to-face. And we spent quite some time. As a matter of fact, we closed down a restaurant that night after my program. And then we talked the next day, and we talked the day before, actually. We spent quite a bit of time discussing various things, and since then we have kept a constant interchange, exchange by phone, email, what have you. And so he has appeared on my program on Addicted to Your Own Destruction, and he's appeared with LB on that program. I think you were there too, Terry. And Daryl has an extensive amount of experience in a lot of different areas, and is very, very well informed as to the history. And he and I come at it from different angles, but we arrive on the same road. Daryl, why don't you tell the folks a little bit about your background? I think you would be better at telling them that than I would. So please proceed, sir.
Well, thanks, Mike. Thanks, Terry, for having me on the show with you tonight and sharing this conversation. I have a similar story with, you know, probably share with millions of people out there now. This day called 9/11, it sort of rocked my world, literally, and my career at that time was an airline pilot, so that really got my attention. And 3 days after 9/11, the company I worked for called me to take the first commercial flight into New York City and pick up passengers on a special clearance. I had the opportunity to fly right over the East River and look down in that smoking hole, what used to be the World Trade Center complex, and can literally tell you that with my own eyes, I looked down in that hole 3 days later, and I could see red and white hot burning embers. I guess they called that molten steel. Well, just to give at that time, it was like, well, nothing's adding up here. Nothing makes sense. And it literally took me 3 to 4 years before I could actually just get over my own cognitive dissonance and start to actually get over the anxiety and fear, to be quite frank about it. And it started me down a path, and it's led me to this point where The only thing that I've been able to bring any sensibility back to my life was critical analysis, objectivity, and looking for the truth no matter where it led me. And it's fortunately led me to have a friendship with Mike and get to meet guys like Terry, at least on the radio, and share time learning and sharing research. So I think that pretty well covers it.
Awesome. Well, welcome to Handling the Truth, Daryl. Where do you want to start this discussion tonight, Mike? Because I know we got a couple of different things on our plate here. This martial law thing is we really haven't talked much about it, and I know that that's something that I don't believe follows a constitutional remedy for the dilemma we're in. So do you want to go into that, or do you want to go on and get back into what we're talking about on Tuesday regarding the fraud of the 14th? And I think Daryl Wayne brought up the Libra Code, and we wanted to get into the Reconstruction. And the question at hand was the old America actually destroyed as a part of Reconstruction following the War of Northern Aggression?
Well, Terry, I believe I would like to finish up on the 14th. I don't think it'll take us that long. And then I would like to jump into the possibility of martial law and the constitutionality of that. But if the Constitution was destroyed, it had to be destroyed immediately after the War of Northern Aggression. And the point being is the 14th Amendment was very much a part of that. And the states, as we mentioned before, 10 southern states were kicked out of the Union, and that we fought a war to keep the Union together. And then when the war was over, we kicked 10 southern states out of the Union. And by we, I mean the U.S. government, kicks 10 states out and puts them in military districts of two states each. They are completely and totally controlled by the military. There's a Union general in charge of each one of those five districts, and their votes are controlled by the military. The votes are counted by the military. Courts are run by the military. Everything is done in those states, and those states are told, pardon me, those states are told, if you will just ratify the 14th Amendment, we'll let you back into the Union. And our question then was and should be, how can an entity that is not in the Union ratify an amendment to the Constitution? And that became a rather sticky issue, and that's where we kind of let off on Tuesday, ran out of time. And I had mentioned what Arkansas did because they were the first. And so I wanted to go over that one again, and then we will jump into a couple of other things. And that should finish up the 14th. Anyway, Arkansas was the first to act, and it adopted its new state constitution on April the 1st of 1868. 2 days later, the legislature considered the 14th Amendment, and by April the 6th, both houses had voted for ratification. But no resolution to recognize the loyalty of Arkansas government was proposed in Congress until May the 7th. So Arkansas had voted to ratify the 14th Amendment as being outside of the Union. I'm not sure how you do that today. Maybe we should probably check the next time we have an amendment to the Constitution. Perhaps we should check with Costa Rica and see if they will amend our Constitution, vote to amend it. It would be the same thing if we follow this rule. And maybe China and Russia, too, to see if they want to vote. But anyway, what happened was on May the 7th, the resolution was adopted. I mean, was proposed, but it was not adopted until mid-June. So 2 months after it's ratified, the Congress says, okay, we will accept your vote, which was made 2 months earlier. Therefore, the vote on the 14th Amendment had been taken by a state which, under the Congressional Act of March the 2nd, 1867, had no legal state government. So then next came Florida, which in May of 1868 approved a new constitution that had been drafted by a convention. Now listen to this, by a convention presided over by Colonel John Sprague of the United States Army all the while in full military uniform. Think there might have been coercion involved there anywhere, or at least the threat of coercion? The new legislature met in June, and as dictated by the acts of Congress as conditions precedent to admission, ratified the amendment on June the 9th. But a problem arose when Congress debated whether to readmit the state. Now, this is where it really gets dicey. Now, listen to this, and you will absolutely see the very essence of politics. It turned out that the wording of the amendment as adopted by Florida differed in several particulars from the phraseology proposed by Congress. So the delegates in Florida changed the wording of the 14th Amendment. Some senators objected that Florida had therefore not properly adopted the amendment. After some discussion, Senator Frederick Frelinghuysen of New Jersey checked the ratifications of four other states chosen at random, those four states being New York, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and then therefore reported that they too had changed the wording in the 14th Amendment, and they had not ratified the amendment as proposed by Congress. And the ratification by Wisconsin, Senator Frelinghuysen stated in one sentence there were four or five errors, some of them most substantive. He also added that if he examined the ratifications of all of the states, he would probably find like inaccuracies in each certificate. Okay, so what is Congress going to do about this? We've got ratification of an amendment with different wording in almost every different state. Almost every different state. Instead of ruling that no state had properly ratified, however, Congress decided that ratification in any form was acceptable. And Florida was accordingly readmitted as to statehood as a legal government. At that point, Congress changed the rules again. Heretofore, ratification of the 14th Amendment had been a necessary qualification for readmission to statehood, but not a sufficient one, which is to say that after the non-government of a state ratified, like I mentioned, Costa Rica or some other place, Congress would consider readmission. An act passed June the 25th of 1868 altered that procedure. The preamble of this act declared that several southern states had, and I quote, frame constitutions of state government which are republican, unquote. Article 1 enacted that each of them, and I quote, shall be entitled and admitted to representation in Congress as a state of the Union, automatically after they ratify the amendment. So again, they're ratifying it not as a state, and they're ratifying it to become a state. Again, coercion. Obviously, however, they were not states at the time they ratified, for if they were, they would have already been entitled to representation. Very, very weird. So on these terms, North Carolina voted to ratify on July the 2nd, South Carolina and Louisiana on July the 9th, and Alabama on July the 16th. According to the tally kept by Secretary of State William H. Seward, that made 28 states, and on July the 20th, Secretary of State Seward proclaimed the amendment ratified. After some congressional wrangling over who had the authority to make that determination, Congress decided to confirm its adoption. Clearly, the 14th Amendment was never constitutionally ratified, even if it had been constitutionally proposed, which is also a question. The question now should become, so what? The critics of the 1950s and 1960s cited, when we were talking about it on Tuesday, call for the Supreme Court to rule that it was constitutionally ratified. I'm sorry, they called on the Supreme Court to rule that it was not a part of the Constitution. Now, this happened in the 1950s and 60s, so not that long ago, 60, 70 years ago. So to the certain objection that such a ruling would overturn a huge body of judicial precedent, so get this, the Supreme Court says, hey, we can't do that because it will overturn all of these other unconstitutional decisions we've made. Make sense? Oh, I just love those guys in the clowns in the black gowns. So, but one of the justices said, wait a minute. We have precedent here. Erie versus Tompkins, 1938. And that, it overturned an earlier ruling in Swift v. Tyson, which was an 1842 decision. And with it, nearly a complete century of case law. And that to right a long-standing wrong was more important than precedent. The Supreme Court said that in 1938. That to right a wrong was more important than precedent. But then the Supreme Court didn't do it. Even so, though no one ever became rich by predicting what the Supreme Court would do from one generation to another, which tells us that the Constitution is exactly what Thomas Jefferson said it was. It was Play-Doh in the hands of the judicial system. And it means whatever they say, it means whenever they say it. So there is no Constitution, hasn't been since 1787. So despite what the Supreme Court has said about the 14th Amendment, we now know that it absolutely does not exist. We also know that, as you mentioned, Terry, the 15th is very questionable as well, and the 16th and 17th for absolute sure were never ratified. So how can we have a valid government that operates in this manner? Now, that's all I have on the 14th, gentlemen. Let's discuss it. What do you think we've come to at this point?
Go for it, DW.
Go ahead, Terry. Well, my impressions I've been left with is that as far as the ratification of the 14th was that the 10 southern states were under military occupation. This is a known fact associated with the Labor Code, Abraham Lincoln's executive order. I believe that was 100, wasn't it? Executive Order 100.
Right.
The Labor Code.
That's correct.
And to put it in digestible and understandable terms, I would just phrase it that the southern states were put on political probation and coerced into performing and basically an oath of allegiance, an extra supra extra constitutional or extra requirements and performance through coercion and extortion in order to ever regain a seat, and that. I mean, that's maybe not the way a lawyer would phrase it, but as a common man, that's the way I interpret it. And so can you – is consent acceptable if it's coerced? Can you make a legitimate contract with anybody – even as an individual man with each other or anybody or anything, if that contract was coerced? No, you can't. So what is that? Is that fraud? They set requirements for their performance that nobody else prior to that ever had to meet. So they had a special criteria for these people or these states, these nations. And then after the fact, after they've done this, the question has to be asked, well, are they actually nations now, states? Are they actual sovereign states? Well, I think history and evidence shows that they lost their sovereignty then, even in comparison to the other states. And so what do you say, Terry?
Well, I'm trying to look at things syllogistically. In other words, if this is true, then that can't be true or vice versa. And I look at Johnson's word, Andrew Johnson, President Andrew Johnson's words in his letter to the Congress when he vetoed when the first Reconstruction Act was passed and sent to him for signature. He vetoed it and sent him a letter. And in that, he says this: to pronounce the supreme lawmaking power of an established state illegal is to say that law itself is unlawful. So they didn't follow any kind of syllogistic reasoning regarding constitutional law. They just made it up as they went along, and I think they pretty much destroyed the entire makeup and legality of the states. I don't think we've had any actual legal states ever since. I think that Johnson was absolutely correct. I mean, everybody should look at that letter because it's a, I mean, it wasn't a short letter. It was quite a few pages, and it was, he said a lot in that letter, and I think he was right on in everything he said.
Well, Terry, I have a question for you then. So I'm in agreement with what you just said, but my question then is, if we don't have the states that we had prior to the Civil War, what kind of states do we have now? What are these things then, if they're not those kind of states? Okay. Are there,
we have de facto governments.
So they,
I heard this said when I first heard this, it simply made sense to me that rather than a de jure government, we've been operating under a de facto government, and people come at that from a lot of different directions, even though their conclusions may be correct. I'm not sure that the direction they've come at it has all been correct, but you know, you've got police power being enforced by an extremely corrupt judiciary. And as long as people are able to go to jail for simply speaking the truth or defying this de facto government, it's going to persist. And that's what we've got. It's not de jure, it's de facto. And it's based on police powers and a corrupt judiciary. Mike, tell me I'm wrong.
So, yeah.
Well, no, there is no way to say you're wrong. And there's a quote from Jefferson that pops into my head. Of course, he hated the judiciary. Let's throw that caveat out there. But here was something he said. Now, take this into consideration with what happened with the 14th Amendment. Now, think about this. Jefferson said the original error was in establishing a judiciary independent of the nation, and which from the citadel of the law can turn its guns on those they were meant to defend and control and fashion their proceedings to its own will. Is that not exactly what happened with the 14th Amendment?
Yeah, it is.
Well, I hearken back to what George Washington said, was that they needed a constitution where the states could be brought to how do you phrase that, Michael? Their imperial will.
The letter from George Washington to John Jay, when he said they had the right to impose their imperial will and to enforce or to coerce will. To coerce the people into agreeing with their will because they had basically a imperial right. And
well,
that was before the convention.
I unashamedly cherry pick different things out of history and fit them in the jigsaw puzzle. And it occurs to me that quote from a letter from George Washington to Jay fits the behavior of that Congress during that Reconstruction period. They're dictating the the terms. And so they're not, we're not talking about equals here. We're talking about subservience and acquiescence. And so that, it just goes back to what you said. We have to destroy it in order to save it. Well, but once you've destroyed it, you can't, they didn't reconstitute it, which fits exactly with what Terry says, it being a de facto. It's not the original. I will just put it this way, that the states since that time, North and South, have been states of the United States and not states of the Union or the Republic. So,
well, to me, it's the thing that bothers me here is everyone talks about stare decisis, already decided. And in the Supreme Court had before them with this 14th Amendment, or later after the 14th Amendment, they had this entire thing laid out for them. Well, I'm sorry, in the 1950s and 60s, they had it laid out for them that the Supreme Court had previously decided, stare decisis, already decided that it was worth the effort to overturn hundreds and hundreds of cases to make it right. And they decided in the 1950s and 1960s, well, no, we're not going to do that. So why do we even consider their precedent anymore? They made their precedent invalid with that decision, and I don't know why someone hasn't filed when the Supreme Court claims precedent over something, while someone hadn't filed and said, well, how can you be arbitrary about precedent? Can you pick what you want to and what you don't want to?
Well, they would.
Well, the evidence says
yeah.
They. So
file
is this?
Whatever you want, are you
saying, Michael? I'm trying to sort this out. Are you saying there's hypocrisy at work here?
Oh my goodness! Please don't. I also thought of another wonderful. Jefferson quote that fits this perfectly, and it fits the whole thing perfectly. And he said in a letter to William Jarvis on September 28th of 1820, now this is well after his presidential and just 6 years before his death, he says, "You seem to consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions, a very dangerous doctrine indeed, and one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Our judges are as honest as other men, and not more so. And their power is the more dangerous because they are in office for life and not responsible as the other functionaries are to elective control. The Constitution erected no such single tribunal, knowing that to whatever hands confided with corruption of time and party, its members would become despots." How did he know that many years ahead of time? And then he said, and I love this, "The judiciary of the United States is the subtle core of sappers and miners constantly working underground to undermine the foundation of our confederated fabric. They are construing our Constitution from a coordination of general and special government to a general and supreme one alone. This will lay all things at their feet. And they are too well versed in English law to forget the maxim that good judges have ample jurisdiction. A judiciary independent of a king or executive alone is a good thing, but independence of the will of the nation is a solecism, at least in a republican government."
I want to answer your question, Mike. You asked, how did he know? He knew because he had studied his history. He had seen it in history. You know, he went back to Cicero and pretty much studied everything coming forward that was
that was
documented.
How did he know anything? Because David Barton wasn't alive back then.
I agree with Terry. as you were asking that question, I was going, well, I'm sure that Mr. Jefferson, and maybe you even have research to prove my supposition here, but I'm thinking that Mr. Jefferson was well read on Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, the Greek civilization, and Rome, and of course, just a little bit of study will demonstrate what happened to Rome and the Senate, and that process. We're sort of reliving that right now in these modern times. So Jefferson understood this. I think many of them did, actually.
Mike?
Well, that was true. And if you look at, if you've ever been to Monticello, and most people won't go anymore because they've made it so damn expensive, the common man can't afford it. But if you have been in Monticello and looked at the books that Jefferson owned, I think that would answer the question we have all had, because all of those works were there. You know, for Jefferson to say of Patrick Henry after 1765, after the House of Burgesses, when Jefferson said Patrick Henry spoke as Homer wrote. Now, how would he know that if he hadn't read Homer? These people, their education was in the classics. They had studied this. They had studied the political thoughts of John Locke and, the other philosophers, Montesquieu and others. They all knew these political philosophies. And so they knew what was going to work and what wasn't going to work. And the other thing that I really like about Jefferson was when he said the germ of dissolution of our federal government is in the constitution of the federal judiciary, an irresponsible body for impeachment is scarcely a scarecrow, working like gravity by day and by night, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, and advancing its noiseless step like a thief over the field of jurisdiction until all shall be usurped.
Mike, can I put you on the spot?
Well,
please do. I love it on the spot.
I mean, it's not like I haven't before, and I probably will in future many times. But my knowledge of what went on in those 10 states, those five districts, how long did that remain that way? And Can you contribute to my limited knowledge as to how those district governors, or whatever you want to call them, how they conducted things, and was there a lot of oppression during that time period? I don't think it went on for years, did it?
Well, it went on from about 1865 to about 1876. So it there are some places it went on a little longer, but it was complete and total oppression. You have to remember that if you were a Southerner who had served in the Confederacy and or ambiguously stated supported the Confederacy, which could have been, and in some courts, some of those judicial courts, a white male was deprived of voting privileges because they had continued to live in the South during the war. And that was supporting the South, according to military judges. So it was complete and total and utter corruption. There are detailed reports of that, some of which I have gone through. It is absolutely amazing what was going on, because those generals there were Union generals. They were all from the North. They brought in carpetbaggers from up North and put them in charge of almost every facet of life in the South. They brought in replacement teachers from up North for all the schools. They brought in replacement preachers for the churches. It was just an overall takeover of the South and everything they stood for, which led to and for those who could afford it, it led to a mass exodus of white males from the South. They moved to parts of Texas. They moved to Arizona. They moved to Colorado. They moved to New Mexico. They moved to get away from that oppression because they had no rights for those years. Elections. Go ahead.
Well, that was the basis of the movie The Outlaw Josie Wells, wasn't it?
In many respects, but if you are really familiar with history, the story of The Outlaw Josie Wells was based on, in many respects, on Jesse James. There were so many corollaries between Josie Wells and Jesse James, it's incredible, and I'm sure that the screenwriter knew about the history of Jesse James to put that together. That was true. But in the South, it was just absolutely incredible, the corruption and the state debt. This is one of the things that I found so remarkable in my studies, is each one of those 10 states, the state debt that these Yankee generals accumulated with their carpetbaggers, not only were the people robbed of their property by just exorbitant taxes, which was in charge of the military leader of those two states, they could, if they saw a piece of land that one of their carpetbagger friends wanted, they just raised the taxes to where they knew the person couldn't pay it. Then they confiscated their land and they took it over.
I think it's important for our listeners to understand that not everyone in the South participated in the Civil War. They were all affected by it, but they didn't all fight in it or participate in it or support it. There were people who, and there's other movies even that, that one with Jimmy Stewart, I think was pretty good, that demonstrated that he wanted to stay out of it, but he was forced into it. I think it's important for people to understand that this Reconstruction Act wasn't limited to those who fought or supposedly were criminalized, if you will, because of their actions. This Reconstruction Act affected everyone and basically created a slave situation. It's really amazing to me that they claimed that they fought to keep the Union together, and then once they won, they destroyed the Union. And they did so by taking away the rights of people who never even violated what they perceived to be proper behavior. Those that conducted themselves innocently through the whole thing were punished in the same way that those people that fought, that wanted to secede.
Well, one of the things, Terry, I think is so overlooked is how terribly blacks were treated in the South. Yes, black males were given the right to vote, but they were just totally oppressed in so many ways by the system itself. Yeah, they got to vote, so what? The military got to count the vote. So it really didn't make any difference. And if election somehow didn't come out the way, because even when he was president, Ulysses Grant overturned an election as president. He overturned an election in the South because it didn't come out the way they wanted it. And he overturned and sent in the military forces and took over the state house to implement the person that he wanted. And we think we've got problems today. This was done throughout the South.
What's the proper constitutional remedy
today
for the situation we're in right now? I know that it's not the courts that are supposed to remedy this. Is it not the legislature that's responsible for remedying this?
Yes, but we have allowed ourselves to get into this position because in 2000, we decided that the Supreme Court could tell Florida to stop counting votes. And if we allow the Supreme Court to tell a state to stop counting votes so George Bush could be president, are we going to depend on the Supreme Court to decide when this fiasco that we're living under right now reaches their desk or their bench? Are we going to say, okay, well, now you already told one state to stop counting votes 20 years ago. We turned an election over to them, and that election in year 2000 should have gone to the House of Representatives. But the Congress sold out many, many years ago. They've sold out their responsibilities because all they're doing in the House of Representatives is for a two-year term. And I've talked with some members of Congress who, and other people who will tell you, especially chiefs of staff that I spoke with when I was working with the POWMIA issue, the chief of staffs run the office because for 2 years, they've got 2 years, so they campaign for 2 years. And it was described to me when I was in Washington, D.C., that if you're in the House of Representatives, it's one long campaign until you're done. I even had chiefs of staff make the statement that they voted proxy votes because years ago they put a control box in each member of Congress's office so they can vote remotely. Congress has abdicated their authority to the judicial branch or to the executive. Congress might as well not exist. My opinion. I sell it for what it's worth.
Well, Mike, earlier today I was thinking about this conversation tonight. And are you aware of when or if the Lieber Code was ever repealed? The military aspect of the Lieber Code, they implemented it, but is there actual an actual date and an act by Congress? Was there a specific date when it says the Lieber Code is no longer in effect? We're not under the law of war anymore. We're under the law of peace. Are you aware of that?
Well, yes, I have nothing specific that I've ever seen that did away with it, but let's consider another thing. There was never a peace treaty negotiated between the North and the South.
Right. I think there was some euphemistic interpretation of words where they didn't call it a war, they called it a rebellion, and under those choice words, there wasn't
war
a,
was never declared. War was never declared,
right,
or undeclared.
Wait a minute now. Congress supported Lincoln in July after the first battle of Bull Run. They actually came in and endorsed all of Lincoln's actions, which had been made unconstitutionally. They ex post facto said that everything you've done, Mr. President, is constitutional.
But did they declare war?
So,
you know, that's a good point, Terry. That is a question that I've never actually pursued. You know, the North committed several acts of war prior to Fort Sumter. And, of course, you know, the South gets blamed for starting the war because they fired on Fort Sumter. Of course, no one mentions that the Yankee Army under Major Anderson had moved from Fort, I was trying to think, what was it, McMurtry or whatever it was. They had moved from one fort where they were officially stationed. They had moved under darkness and in civilian uniforms, which is an act of war, and to take over Fort Sumter, I think it was around Christmas of 1860. And they had moved surreptitiously to take over. And ironically, Fort Sumter was a revenue collection point. Imagine that. So I know I kind of jump traces there a bit, but to my knowledge, a declaration of war, I would have to research that, Terry. I apologize for not knowing.
The few people that I know of that have tried to research that were unable to find any declaration of war or any declaration that it was over. So I'm at least aware of at least three people who tried to find that and could. Maybe you're a better researcher than they are.
Well, I was fortunate, Terry. I don't claim any special traits or anything else. I was just very fortunate during the about 4 or 5 years in the 1980s to have access to the Library of Congress and the National Archives and even the Smithsonian. I had access to those, and I had a tremendous quest for understanding history. And it's not, and I just happened to be at the right place at the right time with access to those documents. So that is the extent of my expertise. I'm sorry.
Well,
this
Terry,
Lieber code issue,
Michael, go ahead.
No, go ahead, DW, please.
Well, I want you to come back to that again, but I just want to bring something else in here from, you know, my studies over the years, and a reference. Terry, are you familiar with a work by Emer D. Vital called The Law of Nations? I'm thinking you probably heard of that.
Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
All of the founders around the time of the Constitution and before were all very familiar with the Law of Nations. That's why it's referenced.
Well, it's an important part of government and conduct and law and precedent and political international law, and it's actually the basis of, as Terry just said, some of the founding principles of behavior and accepted protocols between different nations, and then even how citizenship and rights are determined and applied, and also the laws of war. And There's a section in here in the Vital's Law of Nations, and it's chapter 16 and subsection 192 goes on for quite a while. And it's some interesting parts in it. It says at the head of the chapter here, it says, of the protection sought by a nation and it voluntary submission to a foreign power. And as you start to read through it and you start to look at the subtitles, it's quite fascinating. Section 195 here, the title of it is Rights of the Citizens Within the Nation When the Nation Submits to a Foreign Power. I would propose to you that even though there isn't a peace treaty, or maybe even if there isn't a declaration of war, I guess this is unknown at this time, but that the states were compelled into this contradiction called a voluntary submission. Didn't Robert E. Lee, specifically identify Virginia as his nation, right?
So did Stonewall Jackson.
I don't think they were just using those words flippantly, arbitrarily. I think they had real meaning. Roman numerals. Yeah, it's you'll find it on page 207 in book one of Vital's Law of Nation. You sound like you have a copy of it right there in front of you.
I do. I was just wondering what chapter.
Yeah. Chapter 16.
You said 237. You said 237.
Chapter 207, Terry. And, you know, it may not be appropriate to do original research or investigation on the radio here, but or on the internet. But I'm just bringing this out because Vitel speaks to what I think of what's happening here, and I'm going to have to read this myself or go over it. But almost every aspect of political law and government and citizens is covered in Vitel. And why I think this is so important, this book called Vitel and the Law of Nations, is it was a founding part of the founding documents, and it's carried on all the way, or been referenced and carried on all the way up through the 19th, 20th, and into the 21st century, and I see it going away. I see in my research, and when I listen to people talk and legislators now in the last 20 years, Vitel isn't being referenced. They've come under a new treaty of United Nations. They reference United Nations rights and human rights and political rights, but they've walked away or subsumed, removed reference to the premise of Law of Nations. So I think this is important, and other
law schools, Harvard and other law schools, have negated and denigrated Vitel's codification of the Law of Nations because it basically defined some of the terms of art that the founders operated under when they wrote the Constitution, such as natural born citizen is clearly defined in the Law of Nations.
Right.
And because they wanted to be silly putty in their hands, they have to denigrate the Law of Nations.
Well, they have to denigrate the Law of Nations in the same way that the judicial system and the courts denigrate or ignore Blackstone. Okay, so Blackstone is the basis of operational law in the during the constitutional period and through the 1800s. We have this whole new form of law and new forms of government coming out. This is what's happening in the Rump Congress after the Civil War. I would even go so far as to say that aspects of it definitely happened during the Constitutional Convention. And they keep moving it, and here we are at this point in time now, and we have all this rigmarole going on around us here, politically and legally, and nobody seems to know what the rules are. We're in this transition, and
gentlemen, if I may, I would like to take this back to Vitel when we talk about the law of northern aggression. When we talk about that, because he was considered at that time to be the world's expert on the proper conduct of war, which I found very entertaining. And he said, and I quote, "The people, the peasants, the citizens take no part in war, and generally have nothing to fear from the sword of the enemy. As long as they refrain from hostilities themselves, they live in as perfect safety as if they were friends. Occupying soldiers who would destroy private property should be regarded as savage barbarians." Now, he said that. Now, who did Lincoln get to adopt the rules was Lieber. And Lieber allegedly wrote the Lieber Code to follow what Vitel had said, but yet we have Sherman's March to the Sea, We have Sherman's destruction of Meridian, Mississippi. We have the rape of Athens, Alabama, where the homes were burned. No military was present. And we have the letters himself from Sherman who told his wife, it is my job to destroy not only the soldiers of the South, but the people of the South. He said they all need to be wiped out. And his wife wrote back very nicely, yes, I agree with you. They should all be driven into the sea or something like that. But the crazy thing about Lieber was that Lieber was a German legal scholar, and he was an advisor to Otto von Bismarck and a staunch advocate of centralized governmental power. I wonder why Lincoln picked him. In his writings, Lieber denounced the federal system of government created by the American founding fathers as having created confederacies of petty sovereigns and dismissed the Jeffersonian philosophy of government as a collection of obsolete ideas. So now we know why Lincoln picked him. In Germany, he was arrested several times for subversive activities. He was a perfect ideological fit with Lincoln's political philosophy and was just the man Lincoln wanted to outline the rules of war for his administration. The Lieber Code only paid lip service to the notion that civilians should not be targeted in war, but it contained a giant loophole, which Lieber put in himself, and I will read that. Federal commanders were permitted to completely ignore the code if, in their discretion, the events of the war would warrant that they do so. In other words, the Lieber Code was nothing but purely propaganda. The fact that Lincoln's government intentionally targeted civilians from the very beginning of the war. And, look at the Anaconda Plan. It sought to blockade all the southern ports and inland waterways and starving the southern civilians in the southern civilian economy. Even drugs and medicine were on a government's list of items that were to be kept out of the hands of all Southerners. That's war on civilians. So Lincoln,
that's exactly what they're doing to us today.
Exactly. We're doing the same thing. We're having war perpetrated against us today to deprive us. This government has been rotten and corrupt. Let's go back to 1932 I was trying to think where they starved all the Ukraine, where Stalin.
Oh, you're talking the Holodomor.
Yeah,
Holodomor.
where Stalin was starving the Ukrainian people to death, about 9 million total. And the fact was is that FDR and the U.S. government and the New York Times knew about it, and they didn't publish it. And then 8 short years later, who was our ally in World War II? It's beside me to look at history and to have any idea how any sane individual trusts this government with anything.
Well, you opened the door, so I'm going to stick my foot
in
it.
Jump in there.
But my comment on World War I and World War II, one of the many objectives that it accomplished was it made communism safe in Europe. And I know that that's hard for some people to wrap their heads around, but that's exactly the effect of World War I and World War II, was to make it a safe place for the expression of communism. And a lot of people don't want to hear that, but that's exactly what happened. So,
well, guys, before the war actually got started,
that plan was laid out in the protocols.
Before the war first started, before the first shots were fired at First Bull Run or First Manassas, before those shots were fired, the federal soldiers were plundering and burning homes in the northern Virginia countryside. Before the first shots were fired in the first major battle of the war, they were doing that. And the thing that it became so pervasive of just destroying everything that they came to in the Union Army, it became so pervasive that of all people, General George McClellan, the commanding general of the Army at that time, the Army of the Potomac, wrote Lincoln a letter in which he implored him to see to it that the war was conducted according to, and I quote from his letter, the highest principles known to Christian civilization. And please to avoid targeting civilian population to the extent that is at anywhere humanly possible. So how did Lincoln respond? He replaced McClellan as commander of the army.
Well,
breached the second amendment.
A good example of the...
Pardon me, Terry?
He breached the Second Amendment in Virginia.
Well, he not only did it in Virginia, he did it in Maryland. Lincoln had guns confiscated from any of the people that he thought that were opposing his viewpoint, even in the northern states. That wasn't confined to the southern states. Pardon me.
How many supporters of the Second Amendment hold Lincoln up as their great model?
Well, we have no Second Amendment. That is pie in the sky, because if the Second Amendment stood as it's written, all gun laws, all of them, every damn one of them are unconstitutional.
Well, it's obvious to anybody that cares to pay any attention, but they fall under the section of privileges and immunities. And that's because you have to get a background check. You have to register certain parts of weapons, accessories. So these are just privileges. And of course, we're talking about the 14th Amendment, so I have to say this. If you identify yourself in that status with the civil law, that's all you have are privileges and immunities. I'll just go right out and say it right up front. The Civil War, one of the objectives of it was to overturn the Bill of Rights and put in civil rights. And over a period of, I don't know, 60 years after the Civil War, they brought in everybody under that umbrella of the 14th Amendment, which basically changed the citizenship status of the nation. Well, this is huge, because now they're operating under, you're living under civil law and not the law of the land. Literally. This is a big deal.
Well, guys, you got me started on a point I can't stop on, and being a good Southern boy, I mentioned before that Sherman burned Jackson and Meridian to the ground, and there was no Confederate army there to oppose anything they did. And after the burnings, his soldiers sacked the town, stealing anything of value and destroying anything that they couldn't steal. Sherman biographer Marzalak wrote that his soldiers entered residences, appropriating whatever appeared to be of value. Those articles which they could not carry, they broke. And after the destruction of Meridian, Sherman boasted, and this is his quote, "For 5 days, 10,000 of our men worked hard and with a will in that work of destruction, with axes, sledges, crowbars, clawbars, and with fire. Meridian, Mississippi no longer exists," unquote. He didn't mention any tools of war there, did he? He's talking about tools of destruction.
Well, even normal people, so-called normal people, have heard of Sherman's March to the Sea. So this is a scorched earth policy, right?
You said scorched earth. Here's one of the things that astounded me when I got into the study of that DW and Terry, were you gentlemen aware that the Sherman's March to the Sea is recorded as the fourth worst ecological disaster in the history of this planet?
No.
Yes.
I wasn't. Wow. That's interesting.
I thought that was, when I first saw that, I was kind of taken aback, and then I had to do some further research, and it's listed as the fourth worst ecological disaster in the history of this planet. And you don't hear any of the tree huggers talking about that. I did not pay that close of attention. I'm a Southern boy. I don't look at
that
Yankee thing.
Take a guess, Terry. What do you guess?
Pompeii.
Well,
Pompeii would have to be one, I think.
Some of the hurricanes.
How about the Iraqi oil fields when they lit those on fire?
Well, gentlemen, the one thing that I would tell people who have any questions about the war, I would remind people that when John C. Fremont took his crazy socialist into Missouri at the beginning of the war, the very first thing he did was to free all the slaves. And Lincoln responded by rescinding his order to free the slaves, and he relieved John C. Fremont of command. Now, how many of those wonderful people who are tearing down statues know that? The other thing that really troubles me, if Americans would look, there is a official records of the our Second War for Independence. There are official records, and they're in Washington, D.C., and you can actually purchase these if you so desire. It's called the War of the Rebellion, the Yankee Collection of Facts about the War, the War of the Rebellion, 1861 to 1865, with official reports and official documents in it, 129 volumes and an atlas. If you read through one of those books, you will understand the truth about this war. The rest of it is propaganda and lies. When you read through these official reports about how the Yankee soldiers conducted themselves, what they did to blacks, especially on the coast of North Carolina, when they came in and took over the coast of North Carolina, what they did to blacks is unacceptable anywhere. What they did to blacks in their, what they call the contraband camps, is unacceptable for human life. It's just absolutely beyond comprehension that people with these facts readily available are still out pretending that the South were the bad guys.
Well,
sorry, I get passionate about that. No, I won't. I won't apologize for that. I won't apologize.
No,
I'm passionate about
no.
it, and I'm always going to be passionate about it because this country exists on damn lies. And we're destroying ourselves because of these damn lies.
We've got about 19 minutes left. Mike, you want to shift gears into this martial law issue?
Sure. Go ahead, gentlemen. Jump on it.
DW, do you have something on
Terry.
Your mind about that?
I haven't thought about it. This topic was brought up today in the media. I wasn't listening today. Was this talked about?
Sure. It's been brought up that Flynn and Mecca, whatever his name is, they have asked. Yeah, and there is a group called We the People in Columbus, Ohio, that has asked. This is a right wing, probably with a lot of those right wing Christians in it. They have asked for martial law. They have asked for the military to take over, for Trump to order the military to take over the country in martial law, suspend habeas corpus, and to initiate a new election. Can you say Reconstruction?
Right. Well, my first response to hearing this, of course, I'm not completely unaware that this wasn't a possibility, but it, I'll use a phrase from my Iowa grandmother, and she would say, "Be careful what you wish for." Yeah. So, Terry, I know you got something to say about this.
Well, you know, I'm just sick and tired of the theft of the elections, and I know it's been going on for a long time. And I mentioned Tuesday that I back in 2008 I saw the testimony of Clint Curtis that wrote the software for Tom Feeney to flip votes. So I've been aware of it for a long time, but the extent of how bad this, I mean, talk about a banana republic. We are no longer living in a situation where anything can be trusted, and looking for solutions. If the Constitution, and in fact, is no longer in play as something we can even defend, I wonder what other solutions there are. I would never suggest going against the Constitution, because I've always been a defender of it, even though I know, even knowing how that convention was a criminal conspiracy, and that we were being ripped off by the banksters working through the Federalist, even knowing all of that, I still defend that Constitution, because it's been the only thing that we've had to be able to stand on since that was put into play. So, you know, I'm looking for Mike to provide the solution, to say, okay, here's the way this needs to go down within the confines of the Constitution.
Well, the Constitution has no restraints right now that are going to help in any way, shape, form, or fashion, because the even as you said, even for what it was, what was left of the Constitution after it was made to be putty in the hands of politicians and judges, even with all of the provisions that were there, we have so far castigated and bastardized what was there. There is nothing to follow, Terry. And here's the other point, is we are told about this by groups now that we believe, because they're telling us what we want to hear. And that is one of the worst things in the world, is to have someone tell you what you want to hear because you want to believe it. And how do we know that this election is any more corrupt than the one in 1960? Has anybody been arrested yet? There were over 600 people arrested in 1960. You know, I know this whole election was a farce. I predicted that months before it happened. It was going to be some kind of farce that the world banksters were going to use to complete their destruction of this country after 6 or 7 months of ridiculous lockdowns. They were going to use something else. And why do they keep doing it? Because it keeps working. And I said from 2016 on, how do you get the people that claim to support the Constitution, the people who say they support the Constitution, the people who say that they believe in morality over politics, how do you get those people to say, okay, I'll go along with the destruction of everything just so I can be a winner? Well, the way you do that is you give them a president that is attacked for four years, just attacked every day in the media. It's attacked over and over and over again, to the point to where if you like that guy, if you're a Republican, you love him more every day because the other side's saying bad things about him. It's a psyop. That's how you get these things to work. You convert the people into just absolute cultists to protect their guy because the other side has done everything they can to destroy him. That's how you create a cult. You know, if you want anybody to love anybody, just have Hillary Clinton say something bad about them. We have played right into the psyop. We are, deep in this psyop And right now, we believe what we want to believe because somebody said something we want to think is right. And right now, we've got the right, the political Christian right in this country, willing to destroy everything and put the military in charge of their country, just like some people did with Lincoln in 1860. This is a good thing. Lincoln shut down over 300 newspapers that disagreed with him. There has been a proposal that Trump should shut down all of the media. And ironically, who was it who said in 2016 in a church in Detroit, Michigan, I want to return America to the – I want to return the Republican Party to the principles of Abraham Lincoln.
That was Donald J. Trump.
There is no way to fix this. We are watching a total and complete destruction of everything we believed and thought America was. And who's responsible for that?
Well, the people are, because we've abdicated it all along. I mean, it's the people who believe the lies of the tyrants that are the most dangerous creature. As you call them, Bubus Americanus. That's who's responsible. But at this point, how do we get to a synthesis that's not controlled by the banksters?
The first thing we have to do is survive this, guys. We have to survive this before we can do anything. And the people who survive it have a chance.
Terry, let me ask you a question. What is when you're talking about a solution, tell me or express what your objective is. What would be your objective? What's it look like in fixing this? What would that look like? Would it be a return to something that 10 years ago or 20 years ago or 50 years ago? Well, I mean, we're looking for a fix, and I'm being genuine about the question. What's the objective here?
Well, let me jump in for a second and tell you this. If we think that we're going to ever have anything like a fair, honest government where the people actually have rights, that we're going to have it by voting because we are so terribly outnumbered because of the Marxist education that we've allowed to happen in this country. People have been sitting around complaining about the socialism that's being taught to their children, but they keep sending their children to school because they want babysitters. They don't want to have to take care of their own children. We are reaping the seeds that we planted ourselves. We are reaping those, and it's coming home in bushels. I'm sorry, guys. You guys take it from here.
Well,
there was a group of us a few years back who were trying to encourage the equivalent of committees of safety. Basically, we were referring to them as boards of review as a generic term. You've seen this so-called common law grand jury movement that was really improperly done and lied. They were lied to because they were acting in rebellion to established institutions, and that wasn't going to be the answer. But you look at the Second Amendment, you look at the declarative portion of that amendment, it's not about self-defense or personal individual self-defense. The declarative portion says what? What does it say? It says that a well-regulated militia being necessary for the security of a free state. So, you know, you look at the committees of safety, you look at that sort of thing, and in order to get some kind of control, responsible citizens have to step to the forefront and start putting out writs of mandamus and writs of prohibition against these people who have been put into positions of authority in their areas and take back control of their own sovereignty within their local areas and states. It has to be done community to community. That's the only thing that I can see short of an outright physical violent rebellion. And Thomas Jefferson's words keep ringing in my ear about how you water the tree of liberty.
Well, that's a really good answer. I was actually familiar with that topic of committees of safety and the grand jury process and a few other common law strategies actually. But there's the but. As Michael said earlier in the show, I sort of come at some of this from a different point of view, and or a different area of study maybe. And I come at it from a psychological warfare perspective, and analyzing the left and the right. And I'm a student of Yuri Bezmenov and Golitsyn. These were Soviet KGB defectors. Also Michael Hoffman and political, social, psychological warfare. And I was thinking about this today, and I was just like, I really don't see how to get a critical mass of enough people to take action in this time and place and in the space that we have remaining to prevent either abject slavery or civil war.
We are
of some
closer
form,
to
where
that
it goes
critical
kinetic.
Mass. We're closer to that critical mass
yeah.
today than we ever have been in my lifetime, Daryl.
I agree with that.
Myself.
Yeah.
Bezmenov's work is brilliant, and obviously he was an instructor for subversion and as
yeah.
part of the KGB. And I think his story of his defection is fascinating as well. Him basically blending in with a group of hippies in India. It's pretty interesting. But the point is, I think we need to look at the Magna Carta. I think that really gives us kind of an example of what we need to do.
Well, I would like
that?
To participate
in
those. Well, I said this a couple of weeks ago. I said that it's becoming more and more apparent to me that because I like law and I like rules. But they have to be transparent and provide justice. And I was saying to some people the other day that according to the law, that since it appears that the Constitution has been completely subverted and subsumed, that we have to back up from there and go to the law of the Declaration of Independence, which is a document of law. It is a form of law, and it had authority. And at this point, we're going to have to redeclare it. I say to people that it's becoming more and more apparent that we're going to have to disintegrate before we can reconstitute. And so a big part of me is in agreement with Michael is that we're in a period here where we're going to some of us are going to have to get to the other side, and I'm not really quite – I'm actually pretty sure that I won't be one of them that makes it to the other side because I ain't going along with none of it. Okay. And
we're not alone. We're not alone in that, Daryl. There's people out there right now. There's a fairly large group of people. You talk about a critical mass. There's a bunch of people out there right now who are basically holding on to the Articles of Confederation and saying that that's really what we should be operating under. And they're holding to that. I mean, within their group, within that sect, if you will, they actually have meetings. They have, I mean, they're organized. They're fairly well organized. And there's some nutcases in there, and there's some, and they have some. They'll talk endlessly about things that really are getting them nowhere. But there's a lot of people out there who at least are aware that the Articles of Confederation really is probably the greatest constitution ever created by man in the history that we know of. And it was subverted by, we've got 1 minute of time. It was subverted by the Federalists and the banksters to create this new constitution, which Lysander Spooner is absolutely correct about, and that it either authorized what we've got or it was incapable of preventing it. But we've got to get back to something with more decentralized government, and the smaller the government, the better. And I, you know, Mike's points are well taken. Mike, give us a 1 minute closure here.
Oh, wow, guys. When people ask me, and they've been asking me for years, okay, well, what's your solution? I said, well, I've got a solution, but you won't do it. And that has been, you have to stop. Physics pertains to politics, too. If something is going wrong in politics, before you can change directions, you have to stop. The American public was not willing to stop. They thought that they could fix everything by going to the ballot box and sitting on their butt for the other 3 years and do nothing. And that has proven to be one of the grossest fallacies in the history of man. You just can't fix this. We're going to have to try to put something together afterwards. The Articles of Confederation would be a good start.
Well, thank you, guys. Mike,
well, I
Daryl,
enjoyed
it's been a great discussion.
I...
Daryl, you got any closing comment? I'll give you a minute if you want.
Well, my closing comment was I really enjoyed the conversation. I'd like to do it again. There's a lot to dig into here, and I appreciate you inviting me on. Thank you very much.
Well, good night, everyone. Check in on Sunday night for Mike's show, Addicted to Our Own Destruction, on Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You can find him on Studio A. What time is that, Mike?
That would be 6 p.m. Eastern.
Or 4 p.m. Mountain. Check him out on Sunday night. Good night, everyone, and we'll
Thank
see
you
next
Terry.
Week on Handling the Truth.
Hey, thanks, Daryl. Good night. Thanks, Terry.
Yep. Night, y'all.
Good night,
bye-bye.
Gentlemen.
Government, you sorry rat for fratches. You got yourself an itch and you're wanting me to scratch it. Well, you dat gum, dat gum, dat gum government. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometimes? Stupid and fire starting. Ought to tell you no good frame in a Tory bone frame and nail it to your government walls. All of you, you dead gum government, you sorry so and so's. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Really, you